In Japanese, there's a saying, fall down 7 times, stand up 8 times. And it's literally like that every day. And when you do that every day, you can push the wall back. You can get over that wall many times. And when you can manipulate the wall, you become a really strong person. But most people cannot and do not want to deal with the wall.
In a world where trust is often elusive, Dr. David Matsumoto's journey stands as a testament to his transformative power. As a judo practitioner, he found more than just physical strength on the mat. He discovered a foundation built on trust. This trust in himself and his abilities propelled him to become a USA judo coach, leading athletes to 4 Olympics. But it was a profound act of trust that would forever change his life. When a student bestowed upon him the gift of a kidney, they placed their ultimate trust in his hands. Guided by a service mentality, David embraces each day with a selfless approach, recognizing the incredible impact that trust and compassion can have on those around him. Join us as we delve into the remarkable story of a man who embodies the mantra, fall down 7 times, stand up 8, and learn how starting each day with a selfless heart can truly make a difference in the lives of others. Get ready to be inspired by the extraordinary journey of Dr. David Matsumoto. Welcome to the Forged by Trust podcast. I'm your host, Robin Dreek, professional speaker, executive coach, former U.S. Marine, spy recruiter, best-selling author, and your trust and communication expert. Coming up next on the Forged by Trust podcast.
Being there unconditionally for people. No matter what they do, no matter whether they are successful at it or not, you're always there. And you're there for them, whether you're on the mat or not, off the mat. And you're there for them. You're just there for them, right? They're willing to give everything. I'm willing to give everything. I think there's a thing in society today which is more of an inner focus on whatever feels good rather than serving others in a deeper way. But there's an attitude I start with every day, which is how can I be selfless today?
The Forged by Trust podcast is a show where we explore the essential skill of forging trust for building an innovative culture and exceptional leadership. Join us as we delve into the behavior skills and communication techniques required for success and learn from the best in the industry. Our guests include spies, spy recruiters, master interrogators, best-selling authors, thought leaders, and innovators who will share their insights on building teams, partnerships, and exceptional leadership by forging trust. Today's episode, The Healing Power of Nonverbal Behavior, is with the world-renowned nonverbal behavior expert, Dr. David Matsumoto. Dr. David Matsumoto is a director of Human Intel, is a world-renowned expert in emotion, nonverbal behavior, deception, and culture. He has an extensive academic background and is a professor of psychology at San Francisco State University. He is the author of several influential books in the field of psychology. He has received numerous awards and is a fellow of various prestigious associations. Additionally, he has served as an instructor for the FBI and the U.S. State Department. Dr. Matsumoto is an expert in threat assessment and has conducted groundbreaking research on the behaviors of bad actors and deception indicators. Outside of psychology, he's an accomplished judoka, holding an 8th-degree black belt and coaching certifications. He has won multiple awards and he has held leadership roles in judo organizations, including coaching the 1996 Atlantic Olympic judo team. He was recently inducted into the USJF Hall of Fame for his significant contributions to the sport. During the episode today, we talk about the positive impact of trust, judo as a foundation, a service mentality for life, USA judo coach and 4 Olympics, the life-saving gift of a kidney and trust from a student, fall down 7 times, stand up 8, and starting every day being selfless. David Matsumoto, wow, this has been a long life journey to finally have a fantastic conversation with you, my friend. We have circled the same orbits for quite a while. I mean, I was at Quantico. I got assigned there back in 2007, and I had heard your name over in the other side of new agent training and all the advanced training for interviewing, interrogation, and this nonverbal expert over there, Frenson Joe Navarro, my Jedi master and longtime friend. And so we've been in these circles together for such a long time, but I can't believe it took us this long through our great mutual friend, Michael Reddington, who is an amazing interviewer himself. And so I thank our shout out to him for thanking him for connecting us and for thanking you for coming on the show and sharing your wisdom. So anyway, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, we were in the same circles, and I'm glad that we finally have a chance to talk like this. And there, and you know, how we came about is, as you mentioned, Michael, I've known Michael for years. And when he suggested to talk with you about being on this thing, as you know, I'm a person, as I think you are, you know, when you trust somebody, you, and they're in your circle, it's like, okay, then I don't ask any questions. I just do it. And so here we are.
Oh, my goosebumps are going. We had a beautiful transfer of trust. And that's what's going to be really fantastic about this episode. We're going to focus on trust, even though it's called Forged by Trust, I think a bit more than we have in the past and with some of the past guests. We're always talking about human behavior, and we're always talking about how to interact and create good, strong, healthy relationships. But as always, during our pre-call, you've really brought up an amazing thing, which is really important to me in life, and I think all of us, is identifying pain and helping people move through pain. And you use nonverbals, and you mentioned this, to heal pain. And so you are a Renaissance man of multiple disciplines, judo, which I definitely want to get into because that's where I think some of that origin story comes from. But also, you're an international nonverbal expert and also a human behavior interaction expert, really, about trust. And so, David, all those years ago, where did this journey begin?
Well, thank you for those accolades. I don't know whether I share in calling myself any of those things, but the journey starts like many people's journeys. I think when I was born and growing up, I'm born and raised in Honolulu, Hawaii, and to a wonderful, wonderful family. And there's a big message about trust in the family circle that I grew up in and still have. And I'm very fortunate to have that, because as you know, there's many, many people who are not fortunate to have that trust in their families. But anyway, I was born and raised.
So let's just stop there a second.
Oh, sure.
No, you're already dropping some beautiful words in there. Sure. Trust in the family. How did you define that? What does trust in the family look like?
You know, the thing about it is, as I'm thinking about it, trust in the family may not be as obvious until you can compare someplace where some family unit that doesn't have it. I mean, I never doubted my parents and my brother. I have two brothers. They're
younger or older?
They're both older than me. I'm the baby of the family. Boy, I got a story for you about that too. But
everywhere.
I never doubted that they were there for me. And you know, my family's old school. You know, I mean, my parents are second generation Japanese, and those are as many immigrants and immigrant children are. They're hardworking people. You know, right. And so they were touchy feely. They never said "I love you." However, I never doubted it. I never doubted that they were there for me. And I think that unconscious doubt is one level of trust that's just an amazing thing. I mean, it's not like they never, I never got scolded or I never got, you know, whacked on the butt a number of times, many times. But looking back at how my family was there, I mean, it's, I think that set me on the path for being trusting. Right. And trying to be trustworthy to others. And I think that's more difficult for people who may not have that kind of environment. And you don't think about it like that, right? You don't, many kids, I mean, kids don't think about it.
Right.
But looking back now, I think I was really fortunate to have that family unit where my journey of trust building and trustworthiness started, I think.
It's really fascinating that you can recollect that they didn't say the words "I love you," but you felt that there was trust and you felt safe. How did that show up, do you think, that you were able to feel that emotion from them? What were the actions? What were the behaviors? What do you think was going on that allowed that to show up and give you that sense of safety and security?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm smiling when you're talking about that, because I don't know if I felt the touchy-feely stuff, you know?
Because, right, it doesn't have to be felt touchy-feely, just we have to feel safe. There's a difference.
Yeah, it's the feeling of, it's not even a feeling of safe. It's maybe an unconscious knowledge,
right,
of safety and of knowing that they're there. I mean, I never doubted that they were there in the sense of being there physically for whatever, an appointment, they're going to pick me up, they're going to take me someplace. or just being there in a more metaphorical way, like being there for me, having my best interests out for me, thinking about me. And it's that unconscious knowledge, I think, of trust and safety that is maybe even difficult to speak, difficult to say, at least for me.
Right.
That is different than, you know, a relationship you build later on where you actually feel sentimentally, you feel something towards an affinity towards somebody. And certainly now I have affinity towards my parents. I mean, they're both gone, but I have affinity. But I'm thinking when I was a kid, I don't think I ever felt like I know of the feeling now, if that right. makes sense. It was just an unconscious knowledge that net was there. And that I think there's a level of trust that existed. I mean, I know it. I know that level of trust existed.
Sounds like they were deeply present at the very least.
And, yes.
And involved in your life.
That's a good way to say it. Yes, they were there. They allowed me to go and do my own thing, but they were always there.
Right. Present.
The physical and the psychological meaning of all that word, you know.
Absolutely. It's a generational thing as well. You know,
of course.
You know, our generation is very much the get outdoors and don't go back home because who knows what will happen there. But same time though, you know, you're always looking over your shoulder that mom and dad or brothers and sisters, always there's always someone watching.
Yeah. But that I have a great family. I have and had great family, and that's where it started. Along the way, early on, you know, this is all before this nonverbal psychology, behavior analysis stuff. I started judo when I was 7.
So let's go into that, because this is really fascinating. What brought us to the point? I'm making you really remember things long time ago. I apologize.
No problem.
So judo, that's an unusual thing for some people to get into. What inspired that to happen?
I wasn't inspired at all, to tell you the truth. Sorry. As I said, my two older brothers, I have two older brothers, and my father was a Golden Gloves national champion in boxing.
Wow.
Golden Gloves champion in 1939 and 1940, and a very well known, you know, Japanese American athlete.
What got him into that?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. You know, he's an interesting story because he was born in Hilo, Hawaii, 1919. And, you know, those are the days when the families are working on the plantations. Everybody worked. He had a family of, I don't actually know the number of brothers and sisters he had, because he was kind of the black sheep and we didn't have relationships with them. Huh. But they're somewhere around 10 kids or something. My mother's side too, wow. You know, because they're all on the plantation working. This is all rural agrarian stuff. Right. And he was the second oldest boy, and I guess he didn't get along with his folks. And at the age of 14, I think I'm getting that right, he went on his own from Hilo, Hawaii to Honolulu. You know, and back in the day, you got to get on the boat and take a few days to get to Honolulu to make a living for himself. And so he started working at the time it was the Conservation Corps, you know, and just started working to make a living. And while he was there, he picked up boxing. I think he picked up boxing when he was 14 or 15. And he happened to be in a boxing club that was pretty well known in Hawaii for producing great boxers. And by the time he was, let's say, 18 or 19, he was winning matches in Hawaii and was part of a team that went to nationals and won Golden Gloves. I mean, it's just an amazing story. I've gone through all of his scrapbooks and albums and whatnot and made a little presentation for my family a couple of years ago, because I had the time, you know, we're in COVID, right. Have nothing to do.
So right. Good COVID project.
But it was just an amazing, it was great for somebody to have put it together.
Yeah.
And he never talked about it. You know, he had a heavy bag and a speed bag at home, but his policy was he didn't want his kids to do boxing because it is brutal. It's just a brutal thing. Of course, so what does he do? He gets his kids into jujitsu, right?
Yeah.
So my two older brothers did a little stint in jujitsu, and then they transferred to judo. And so because my older brothers did it, when I came around, it was time. It's just time to go and do that. So that's the inspiration. I mean, I was not inspired to do that at all. Like I was not inspired to do piano because they did it, and whatever else they did, I had to do, you know.
So you did piano as well?
I did piano as well. And so we're going to end that story right there.
Okay. So at this age, you know, all right. So how many years did we do judo, which kind of brought us in? I'm looking to move from here up to high school and kind of seeing, oh, all right, what's going on here? And where's our brain at this point? Do we have a direction we want to walk in life at, or are we just kind of taking it one day at a time?
Well, you know, I had a direction when I was a kid. And so I'm doing judo all this time. I got to tell you, I'm hating it. I hated judo. I just hated judo with a passion.
And why?
Well, listen, I mean, most people don't like judo until you get somewhat good, because it's just tough to get slammed all the time. It's not fun, you know? So, right. And when you're a kid, it's either fun or not fun. And believe me, getting slammed and yelled at all the time is not that fun. And I was very fortunate to get better when I was 14 or 15. And then I really loved it. And then I couldn't be away from that.
What kept you going back?
Oh, it was my dad made me go. There's no question about it. You know, right. Like, dad says, okay, we're going to go. I mean, I used to come up with all these excuses to not to go. And he just wouldn't listen, just threw me in the car. And I went.
Okay.
And he dragged me. But, you know, the interesting thing is, around 15 or so, I got good. I was on a team that went to Japan for training, and I came back and I didn't know it. You know, you don't feel it, but right. Apparently I was way better. And then that just started my climb to being better. And, you know, in judo, like many other martial arts and combat arts, I think things are not fun until you get good to right. some degree.
Isn't that life?
Yeah. That's true. But around that time, I'll give you an interesting story. You know, back to your question, I was planning to be a pre-med. I thought I was going to be a medical doctor. And I remember sitting one day when I was around 15, because it's around this time, I was sitting there with my sister-in-law, my oldest brother's wife, and we're watching a TV show called the Bob Newhart Show.
Oh, I love the Bob Newhart Show.
Oh, yeah,
The Darryls.
That means you're old as I am, you know? So.
Yes.
We're sitting watching the Bob Newhart Show, and my sister-in-law, Theo, says to me, I hope you don't become a psychologist. And I said, yeah, who'd want to be a psychologist, right? And so here I am. I became a psychologist. But I was a pre-med major. After I graduated high school, I went to the University of Michigan.
I'm so sorry for all the interruptions, just filling out nooks and crannies. Where do you think this desire to do pre-med came from? I mean your dad was, you know, a boxer.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, he was a boxer. He turned pro, and then the World War II started, and they didn't allow Japanese Americans to do things like to do pugilistic things. And he always liked to work with his hands, according to him, and he became a plumber. And so he was a journeyman plumber for all his wow. working career after that. In fact, after the war started, he became a plumber and he worked at Pearl Harbor, you know, so go figure, right? So,
and is it okay? I'm curious to go there a bit. Anything he experienced during those years that kind of forged him or kind of passed along any sorts of lessons to you? Because what I'm finding really interesting is, you know, the world is generally a dichotomy between wound collectors, people who feel victims, and problem solvers who move forward. And it sounds like he was the type of guy that solved problems and moved forward instead of collecting wounds and feeling slighted or getting retribution. Maybe, I'm guessing.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, that's one already, right? When he was a boxer and he was made to quit. And then he became a plumber. And right around the end of the war, and this is what was told to me by both my parents and my brothers, when my oldest brother was one or two, and this is like 1945 or 1946 or so,
wow.
My father, working at a construction site, you know those wrecking balls that go back and forth? Well, he was hit by one. And then apparently he was in Tripler Army Hospital for like 6 months in a body cast or something like that. I mean, but, you know, it was a story that he just told. It was never... never something that crippled his mind so much that it became part of our history. It was like just that thing that happened, and they thought he was going to die, but he didn't. And so here he is. He just continued his work. And I think that kind of philosophy of life just kind of permeated my family. Like my brothers are both like that. I'm like that. I mean, you know, you get an injury, so what? You get this, so what? I mean, just problem solve. Like you move on. Yeah, you find. I mean, there's a time for mourning or being angry or whatever it is. But then there's time to pick yourself up and just go, right?
Right.
And that was part of his history. And I, you know, that's one of the one of the things that we learned about him that I think was just his attitude, which probably, and my mom is like that too. Their attitudes permeated how we were brought up, I think. And all of us are just kind of like that, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. That's incredible. All right. So I interrupted on the sidebar. Thank you.
No problem.
Move us forward.
Yeah. So I'm going to the University of Michigan. I thought I was going to be a physician. I did some of the pre-med requirement courses, you know, when I was a freshman and sophomore. I didn't do great in them, but I was doing okay at them. And I was at this point where I was questioning what I was doing. And so then a guy in the dorms that I was living in, who was a psych major, suggested to me, "Hey, why don't you take a psych course?" And I said, "Okay, I'll try." And I did. I think the first one I did was either my end of my sophomore year or the beginning of my junior year. So it's kind of late in my university career.
Yeah.
And I did well. I have no idea why I did well. But then I just continued to take more psych courses. At the end of my junior year, I had a good GPA, but I didn't know what I was doing. Right. And so, but because I had a good GPA, one of the professors at Michigan in the psych department, a very well-known professor, Eugene Bernstein, asked me, and I didn't know these guys were famous at the time, right? I'm just a kid at school.
Right.
Because I'm in the field later on, I'm going, wow, he asked me, wow, you know what I mean? So, but he asked me to become part of the undergraduate honors program. And I said, sure. Sounds great. What do I got to do? And he says, well, you got to do a study. And I said, well, sounds great. What is that? And he says, well, what are you interested in? And I told him, I was, and I still am interested in how young children and infants can understand their world and their caregivers without understanding language, because that's just an amazing ability that human infants have.
Right.
And he said, wow, if you're interested in that, you got to go and talk to that guy over there who happened to be one of the most famous social psychologists of all time. And I didn't know that either. And I went to, his name is Bob Zients, and I was fortunate to work with Professor Zients to do an honors thesis. And I completed my degree in psychology through his tutelage. And I got into grad school in psychology because I thought I wanted to be a therapist.
Right.
Did you stick
with judo the entire time as well?
I'm doing judo the entire time. Judo is the activity that has fueled everything. So, you know, I could have been studying or doing anything else, but judo was the thing that kept me going.
What do you think about it kept you going? Where did that fuel come from?
There's a lot, several reasons. First of all, you know, the thing about it is I was really fortunate to have a great initial judo instructor. It's like anybody who's your first instructor of something that is very influential in your life. And his name is Takao Fujitani, and Fujitani Sensei, but we call them Sensei, right? Was my initial judo instructor. And in my judo life, I mean, I've been doing judo for 50 plus years. And, you know, when I look back, I had him from 7 to 17, which is only 10 years. But that, I mean, those are the most important 10 years, right? So, but his, you know, talk about philosophy, which wasn't, you know, these things are not talked about. I mean, they're talked a little bit. It's like my parents, right? It's just the way you live.
Right.
And so part of doing judo with him was, as you got better and as you were moving towards a promotion to black belt, you had to be helping others and you had to be teaching children. And so no matter how good you were or not, as you were moving up, you had to donate your time to teaching kids classes. And so I did that since I was 14 or 15. And the routine of being at a kid's class and then to my practice, that routine while I was studying or supposedly studying and doing whatever I was doing just gave me mental time discipline. It was just a time discipline that I have today. I mean, I have judo today. It's Friday. I have judo at 5 o'clock. And so I need to get things done before I go to dojo. Right. And so I've lived that life of time discipline for over half a century. And it started back then. And he gave me that. And he gave me, of course, the other discipline, which is just the perseverance. I mean, judo training is not easy. And back in the day, I hate to say that, but I'm, you know, back in the day, now it's a sport training. It's like sports training, which is right. also tough. But back in the day, it was more brutal for lack of a better word. It was more of a martial art.
Right.
And so one develops the perseverance and, you know, that kind of discipline to get through anything that's tough. You know, anytime you get through some things like that, everything else is just a piece of cake.
Right.
Everything's a piece of cake. And so there's the mental discipline and the just the gut perseverance level that I learned from him. And, you know, now I'm thinking as we're talking, because my parents, he was friends with my parents. Huh. And, you know, they had obviously had some level of trust because my parents started their three kids in judo under him. And because of that, you know, there was never a thought about, you know, I'd have another instructor or I don't like this, I'll go someplace else. I mean, talk about an unspoken, unconscious level of trust that goes beyond words.
Right.
There was that too, because no matter how awful the experiences were, I mean, I hated it and I hated him sometimes, but you know, there's that unspoken, unconscious trust that I mean, it's hard for me to even verbalize.
Yeah.
But it was there. And so I followed him and I learned those lessons like I did with my parents. And separately from all of this, this is also ringing another thing. You know, I have two great brothers. One is now gone, but I have two great brothers. And I've always thought, because later on, I mean, I'm jumping around. As you know, I've got a PhD. And I've always learned early on, a PhD is a great thing. Academic achievements are great things. I don't want to downplay that. But in terms of trust, talk about trust. You know, I've known throughout my life that if I ever had a problem, a personal problem, there were like four people I would go and talk to.
Right.
My dad, who barely made it through elementary school. My judo instructor, who was a high school grad and, you know, not college person. My second brother and my two brothers. Right. My second brother, who barely made it through high school himself. And then my oldest brother who is a college grad and got a master's degree. But my point is, academic achievement has nothing to do with that, right? It's not what you've achieved and how much money you've got and whatever degree. That trust about, if I'm really in a bad shape, who am I going to talk to? Right. I've known this forever. It's going to be those people. And
They're consistently there in your life.
Yeah.
I'm guessing they were maybe dropping truth bombs when you needed it because they care deeply about you, but they allowed you to make the choices you needed to make because they weren't tied to your outcome. And they were unconditional with their proactive inserting themselves and being an inspiration to you throughout life. Yes.
If I could, if I had the ability to verbalize it like that, I would have just said it like that. But when you said the truth bombs, I remember the time when one of my older brothers used to come and say, "Hey, David, it's time to talk." I said, "Okay," and I'm going, "Oh my gosh!" <come. laughs> And we go in the room. He shut the door and he closed the turn off the lights. And I go, "Okay, here the truth bombs are coming, right?"
Right.
But yeah, that was you're exactly right. It's they're unconditionally, whatever it is, we're good or bad, and that's really what it is.
That is,
and it reminds me. You know, I have so many associations when we're talking. I mean, one of the things about that is so powerful about judo, going back to your question, is because, as you know, when you're in the trenches of the dojo trying to eke out a breath
right,
while you're being slammed and pinned and choked and locked and for hours and hours, day after day, week after week, you develop some pretty good friendships with people who go through that with you.
Yeah.
And yes. And those friendships, which are forged by trust on the mat through the hardships are lifetime. They're just amazing. There's not a lot. There's a few of them, but you do anything for these people, right? That you've gone through this with you. And I want to tell you about one that happened for me as well. I mean, I've been very fortunate to be a national coach for USA Judo since 1989. And, I've been to 4 Olympic Games and 12 World Championships.
I'll back up 1 second. So how did you become the national coach for judo? That's crazy. Incredible.
I was running a little dojo here in Berkeley and the East Bay of San Francisco area. And, the students were doing well. And when your students do well on the national stage, you get noticed as a coach. And so I was asked by the coaching staff at the time to join the coaching staff.
So I'm going to stop again.
Sure.
Students just don't do well. It obviously comes from amazing coaching. What do you think you were doing that inspired them, that reverse optic, that inspired them to raise their bar and push beyond what they probably would have done with someone else? What did they do?
First of all, I want to acknowledge that the primary person in all of that is the student, right? It's that person, because it's not easy to, when you're getting slammed all the time, it's not easy. You got to be the one to pick yourself up, and no one can pick yourself up for you, right?
Right.
And so number one, it's them. But what I did, to your question, is I was always in the trenches with them. I would, whatever I asked them to do, I would mostly do. Whenever it came to the it's called randori, but the sparring time of judo, I was always there. I'm still there. I can barely walk some days, but once we go on the mat, and if we've got players or people who are just trained to be better, I mean, I'm on the mat with them.
Right.
And so I think that it's being on the mat there, creating the situation where it's just awful for them, but they're growing. But then spending the time later on spending the time and being with them and showing that you care for them as individuals, and not you just want to slam them all the time. I mean, if you just want to slam them all the time, no one wants to be there. It's all because you have a relationship, and you got to create that relationship. And I found that creating a relationship starts, number one, on the mat with them, working out with them, sweating with them, dying with them, but then going out and having a pizza later on and doing that for their lives. I mean, these people are, doing years of judo, that kind of training. And if they're willing to dedicate, I'm willing to dedicate back. And
isn't it amazing that you got to that level because of the behaviors you're now modeling with a combination of your dad and the coach and your family? And that's that arc.
Oh yeah. There's no question.
They were forged so early on. What a beautiful arc that was.
There's no question about that.
Yeah. So keep going. I'm sorry. So that's how we got there. All right. So
that's okay.
Let's keep going.
By the way, I love this conversation, because even though you and I were revolving on the circles about behavior analytics and interviewing and interrogation, here we are talking about judo, which is great, but.
Because think about it. It all revolves around the same thing. We're talking about all the behaviors that inspired the behavior, inspired the choices we make in life, which is
no question
life. Because most importantly, it's so enjoyable. And I think inspirational to people, at least it is to me, when you see someone as accomplished as you. I mean, Olympic coach, world-renowned nonverbal expert, PhD, obviously a great human being that people would love to have in their lives. That arc started somewhere, it's a place that we all can be.
Yeah.
And something that we can all achieve if we know, all right, things in my life are going in this direction. All I have to do is shift the rudder a little bit over here, and it can go another direction.
Oh, yeah. It comes back all to those relationships. I hate to use the cliche, your moniker is a cliche, but forged by trust through all those difficulties and good times. I mean, it's just being there, like you said, unconditionally for people. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to be part of the coaching staff in 1989. And, you do tours and you go around, you take athletes to various teams, and my students are doing well. In 1993, I was I was part of the national coaching staff, and I actually was asked to become the chairman of the coaching staff because there's vacancies and whatnot. And 96, because I was the chairman of the coaching staff in 96, I was the head coach and the team leader for the our Olympic team, et cetera, et cetera.
I could take forever going down each one. Just really quickly, why sure. do you think they chose you? There's a lot of people competing for these positions. What are people seeing throughout their lives when they see you?
Well, they can trust that of what they see, because I am what I am, and I'll speak my mind. And, you know, I'll give you an example. Like if you're in the judo world and I hate to say it, but you can kind of tell whether a player is going to make a certain achievement or not in the next year or in the next half year. And so I was okay with saying no to a lot of people and to a lot of people about a lot of things, and saying yes when I meant it. And when I say what I mean, and I mean what I say, and I followed up with whatever actions, whether it's training plans, policies, programs, or whatever that was. And I think it's just being that consistent and true to yourself and true to my thoughts that perhaps people saw that allowed me to, you're right. I mean, you got to get voted in
right
over a competition to get a slot.
You're forging great healthy relationships by dropping loving truth bombs along the way.
You're exactly right. I mean, you don't have to be nasty about it, you know, but you know, if you speak the truth and you can be professional and courteous and all that kind of stuff. But I 96 and 2000, and I went to Athens, and I was a member of the international, I was an official of the International Judo Federation. But through all this time, I've been training athletes at that level. My daughter's one of them. She made the Beijing Olympic Games.
Oh my gosh.
And training your own kid from the time she started. I mean, I think we're the only dojo that has a kid that started and went to the Olympics with the same and their parents in the same dojo, let alone parent child. I mean, I think we're the only one in the country that has ever done that. And there's a story about trust, because I, you know, for her to have gone through everything that I made her go through, which I would have made anybody go through, but that, you know, at that level, it's bordering on inhuman.
Right.
And she never publicly doubted it. I don't know what she did outside, you know, but she went through it. And like so many other athletes that I've had the honor to work with. And one of them, who's, I want to say his name, but wasn't planning to talk about him, but I want to. And I usually ask him for permission before I use his name, but let's just call him Michael.
Okay. Sounds great.
Yeah. I was training Michael, who happens to be the son of one of my best friends, my best friend, who's also in judo. And I was his competition coach. His dad was his dojo coach, but I was his competition coach. And from, I don't know, the early 2000s through 2012, I went around the world with him, coaching him in competition. And he would spend much time here in my house at training at my dojo as well, to do all this, to do the training for that kind of stuff. And, you know, training at that level is a 6 day a week, two or three training opportunities every day. I mean, it's a professional job, basically.
Right.
And it's not easy. I mean, I had him on a strength program and a conditioning program, a nutrition issue, and then we've got a judo issue. I mean, to take one player at that level, you got a team of 10, you know, and I'm directing the team of 10, and I'm with him on the mat all the time, as well as going around the world in competition, good or bad, right or wrong. You know, like you say, it's unconditional. Whether he wins or loses, you know, you're always there.
Right.
And I'm jumping ahead because I since 2010 or 11 or so, I don't remember when I was initially diagnosed. Oh, it was earlier. I was diagnosed with kidney disease of unknown origin. Nobody in my family has it. I'm not diabetic. I didn't have, you know, all the other signs that produces kidney disease.
Right.
And it went bad for over the course of like 9 or 10 years, to the point where I needed a transplant. It was either dialysis or transplant.
Right.
And because I'm such a stubborn person, I kept working out and kept working out, and I kept shocking my medical staff, because I'm always working out, doing judo. But it came to the point where I needed to get a transplant and or get on dialysis. And I let my, you know, I have a small circle of people who friends and family who I immediately trust. And I was very touched because, I mean, I don't broadcast. Like, I'm not the person that kind of broadcasts. And if you are, that's really fun. I'm just not like that. And I don't broadcast, hey, you know, I'm looking for a kidney. You got one today.
Right.
And I think, so I just tell a few people, but I remember to this day, 9 people stepped up and wanted to donate. 9 people mm-hmm. wanted to donate. And then they went through the testing and whatnot. And to make a long story short, the one that I got was from my athlete, whose name is Mike. And we're not blood related. He was a match and he donated. He gave me life.
Wow.
This is after he had competed. I mean, he was done competing and
right.
on, you know, working, and he has his own dojo. And talk about a story of trust.
Yeah.
After, you know, giving, I guess I was giving, but that's just what I do. And boy, did he turn around and give back. I mean, and you know, the thing about it is there was a time when we were all testing and we were all going down the road to, okay, we're going to do it. And it narrowed down to him because he was the best match. He said, yeah, no problem. And there was a time when the hospital asked him, you know, we could do this mixed match thing where he could donate, just make an open donation, and then I could get a slightly better match from somebody else. He said, nope, I want to give it to him.
Right.
And we actually we scheduled it. Actually, we're in August of 2016. Wow. We're just talking. He wanted to do something in November. And I said, okay, so we picked a date, and I told the hospital, and you know, he showed up. I did it on a Friday. He showed up on Wednesday, and we worked out on Wednesday together. And we're sitting there sweating on the afterward. We took a picture, and Friday we walked into the hotel, not a hotel, hospital.
Right,
and
right.
He gave me his kidney. It's just an amazing thing. And I've cherished it ever since. And he's healthy, which is really great. But after I talked with you the last time to the pre-call, I would, like I said, you've been in my head. Your topic has been in my head. I don't know about you, but your topic has been in my head. And I thought, wow, of any story I could tell about trust that was forged and given,
yeah,
that's got it. For me, that's got to be it, because I must have done something right and he's done something right. I don't know what it is, stars aligned or something, but.
No, it's so I know you'll never give you the credit that others will give you because of who you are, but I'll give you the credit. It's because of you. You know, one of my other favorite authors is Robin Sharma. He wrote one of the great bestsellers, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And one of his books I read recently, he has a great question. I ask this in a lot of the courses I give. And besides, what will you do in your last 5 hours on this planet? And this isn't like the bucket list question. This is, you literally have 5 hours left. What do you do? And inevitably, it's spend time with family, having a great conversation with the people you trust and have good, healthy relationships with. But his is a next step further beyond that 5 hours is, who will cry when you die? And you just listed at least 9 people. Most have 4.
Yeah.
That's the average, believe it or not. And so that just shows extremely life well lived because of this arc that you have, okay, because of how you take care of others. Because, and this will bring us back to the center theme, which goes to you've used judo as a way to get close. You've used sure. judo to touch lives, to be of service, which your yeah. first sensei taught you, but also to heal pain. So can you bring that all together for us? So what did you learn about nonverbal behavior from judo, and how does that translate into healing, seeing and healing the pain in others, you think?
Well, judo has so many lessons. And with regard to the nonverbal behavior, I mean, judo is great because it's all behavioral and everything one does is behavioral. And judo is unique among martial arts because we actually grip each other.
Right.
And because of this grip, which is also nonverbal, right? This grip, we have communication and we can communicate with each other. And because of that nonverbal communication, whether it's in the feel or even the sense, I don't know whether it's pheromones or their face, or it's definitely, certainly their posture and the way a person carries themselves, you know, you know immediately when, or I've known immediately when a person's afraid or they're not, they're sad.
So what does that feel like? So David, you have decades of reps that I know I keep trying to have you place labels and meanings on this thing that's become extremely intuitive to you because you have a mastery level because of all these reps. What do you think that is that, you know, you're translating when you just get that touch that you can feel that pain, you can feel that insecurity, you can feel the fear, or you can feel the confidence, you can feel they're about to explode. What it is, you know, are you able to dissect any of that into what you're actually sensing?
I'm not sure whether I can do that, to tell you the truth. I certainly sense it. It's very strong. And I know why I sense it, which is because judo, like many other things, you know, you are, for lack of a better term, psychologically naked.
Right.
You know, it's just you and somebody else, or you and yourself, against the wall that you that we all have, and that we, most of us, back down from because we want to protect our sense of self somehow. And judo, at least the way I train it, is you go up to the wall every day, and you climb. You can fall down. You know, in Japanese, there's a saying, fall down 7 times, stand up 8 times. And it's literally like that every day. And when you do that every day, you can push the wall back. You can get over that wall many times. And when you can manipulate the wall, you become a really strong person. But most people cannot and do not want to deal with the wall. But judo, the way we do it, gets people to that psychological wall. And thus, when you're there and you can grip somebody up, it's, you just feel how they are at that moment. And you, it's like knowing their inner sense. I mean, it's whether they're confident or not, and they're arrogant or not, they're afraid or not. And my job is to know what it is, not for my students anyway, so that I can help them overcome that. I want everybody to be the better person, which means to be that stronger person. And I'll get them to that place, not because I'm sadistic, you know, it's because I want them to be able to manage that part of that difficulty. And you can feel it. I mean, you can feel it. And even if I don't touch somebody, I can watch somebody. I can see that in the way they carry themselves, or the way they move, the way they stand. It's very clear to me. And it's all those, I'm now verbalizing what I think I do, but it's all behavioral analysis at that point. And That's what I think is the best thing about judo, which is, I mean, there's the physical aspects and all that, but helping you grow as an internally strong person like that, it has so much benefits. And that's what I think I've been trying to do.
No doubt. So when you see the pain, what do you do about it? How can you help people through it?
Well, it's not easy. Number one, I think I'm going back to what you had thankfully labeled for me about my upbringing, which is being there unconditionally for people. No matter what they do, no matter whether they are successful at it or not, you're always there, and you're there for them whether you're on the mat or not, off the mat. I mean, like, I have judo students and their families will call me and talk to me about school, about personal issues, about whatever it is. And you're there for them. You're just there for them, right? They're willing to give everything. I'm willing to give everything. I mean, really, that's what it is. My time for them doesn't stop when practice ends. They're willing to give. I'm willing to give. I'm willing to give, and I think they're willing to give. I think it's a reciprocal thing, you know. So, but I think you labeled it. I think it's that unconditional presence, for good or bad. And I bring the bad, right? I bring the bad, meaning I bring them to the wall. And so, but I bring it because I want them to get over it. You know?
What do you think hinders people from doing that these days, from being present?
My first thought was technology and social media, but I think there's something deeper than that. I think there's a thing in society today, which is more of an inner focus on whatever feels good rather than serving others in a deeper way, you know. And I think how I think about things is as much a product of the time in the late 50s and early 60s and 70s, growing up during that time with my, you know, basically immigrant families working in a plantation.
Right.
That led me to think like that. But it's not just me. I mean, I know so many people in that who were brought up in those years that just think differently. I mean, it's not just every generation has its own thing, but I think there's a big difference between that generation and now. You know, kids now and society now is very different. And I think there's not as much of a focus of service. I think service is the issue. Yeah.
I think part of that service is the, and this arc that we're seeing in the, what's going on now in the world is, at least I'm seeing it, is a challenge that people are having with problem solving.
Yeah.
And and so what would you suggest that people can do utilizing the skills, tools, and techniques as you developed over these years, maybe one or two things they can maybe start incorporating in their lives at any age, but especially young? How can people start being better problem solvers so that we're not going from 0 to 100 or 0 to hate?
Well, so that's a great question. And I have a different, what I think is probably a different take on that. It starts with an attitude, and it's an attitude that I start with every day. I don't know whether the people around me will actually believe it or not, because they see me in a different context, but there's an attitude I start with every day, which is how can I be selfless today? How can I don't want to say serve others, because it starts, I think, with being selfless. All that stuff you just mentioned ego and all that stuff starts because we put ourselves first, right? And our, whatever our fragile or strong sense of self, that becomes first. And thus we have all these emotional reactions and pain that becomes impediments to our being successful and from serving others well. And I think it starts with, for me today. And if you asked me this question maybe 10 years ago, I would have thought about it differently. But today, here we are today, and it starts for me of starting every day with how to be selfless. Starting, and before I talk to you and before I click the Zoom, I take a moment and think, how can I be selfless? How can I interact with Robin so I can be selfless to give a story that can help others? I mean, I try to do that before I talk to everybody and do anything.
And that's how you be present.
I think so. I think that's how I do it anyway.
Yeah.
I'm not successful at it each time, but.
Oh, beautiful.
I try.
David, that's absolutely beautiful. I'm so glad you shared that. That is so poetic and so perfectly stated. David, we could go on for hours, but we can't. I'm sorry. What, if anything, would you have liked me to have asked you that I didn't get a chance to ask you that you wanted to make sure you shared, if anything, before we sign off?
You know, I don't think there's anything, because this has been of the many, and I'm very fortunate about that, podcasts and talks I've done. I don't think I've ever had a discussion like this. And which gets to what I think is the point of everything, the point of living, the point of, you know, working in law enforcement, the point of being a teacher, the point of everything, which is the topic that we talked about today. And so, yeah, we could talk more about what we talked about today, but I think, I don't know if there's a different question, to tell you the truth, you know.
Awesome. David, where can people go to find out more about you and bring you into their lives so that they can learn more about the most important thing? And like you said, is how to be selfless and be of service.
Well, if you want to learn more about the behavioral analysis stuff, it's my company. It's www.humintell.com, H-U-M-I-N-T-E-L-L. Want to learn more about my dojo? And I have a wonderful set of instructors, and I'm not the head instructor anymore. It's the East Bay Judo Institute. It's www.ebji.org. And but if anybody is ever in the area and you want to come down, and there's nothing like watching it, right? There's nothing like watching it and seeing the practice unfold. It's just an amazing thing. So if you're ever in the area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, look us up.
And it's all in the show notes, as always, folks. David, I can't thank you enough for dropping beautiful truth bombs on us all today and being such an inspiration. The service you give to our society is tremendous. And we didn't even cover all the other areas that you do for law enforcement, for our nation, for the world at large. So I just profoundly thank you for all you do and coming on and giving us a small glimpse in this beautiful arc of your life.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And thank you for allowing me to talk about these topics that I generally never talk about with anybody else. And I'm so happy to have done it. And thank you for your service and everybody else in your audience as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of Forged by Trust. Remember, if you want to forge trust, it's not how you make people feel about you that matters. It's how you make them feel about themselves. If you're interested in more information about how I can help you forge your own trust building, communication, interpersonal strategies as your coach, a trust advisor, or a speaker for your organization, please visit my website at www.peopleformula.com. See you next time on Forged by Trust.